much harder to do that research without foreign faculty and foreign students.
And the role of the courts, we just heard about the Vermont judge, yeah. The New Jersey judge, overall, your assessment of them and the Trump administration, how it's responding first term versus this term. You have Stephen Miller, you just heard, saying this is a judicial coup when they are ruled against.
Yeah. I think that, you know, many of the district court judges are doing exactly what the Constitution demands they do. You know, the district court judges are ruling against the Trump administration in many of these contexts. We'll have to see what the Supreme Court does. You know, so the Supreme Court so far has been extremely cautious. You know, one theory is that they're worried about the Trump administration not complying with their court orders, and they're worried about the loss of institutional credibility that would come if the Trump administration ignored their court orders. But that's itself a kind of terrifying thing, that we're, you know, at the point where the Supreme Court is worried about whether the executive branch will even honor the Constitution in that way.
And if we could ask you about the case that you yourself, you're representing, the Knight Institute is representing, the American Association of University Professors and the Middle East Studies Association, challenging the Trump administration's large-scale arrests, detentions, and deportations of foreign students and faculty who've been involved in pro-Palestine protests. If you could talk about that case.
Yeah, so this is a challenge to the policy of arresting, detaining, and threatening to deport students who participated in pro-Palestinian protests last year. You know, as we've already discussed, there are cases in which individual students who have been targeted have challenged their arrest and detention and threatened deportation. The Mahmoud Khalil case is one of those cases. But this case is a challenge to the deeper policy, and it's brought on behalf of faculty at universities across the country. And what they are pointing out is that these detentions have obvious implications for the students who are detained, but they also have this very profound chilling effect on all of the foreign students and foreign faculty who are worried about the possibility of being targeted. And this policy has really transformed life at universities around the country, really put a kind of blanket of fear and repression over these, you know, over campuses all over the United States.
And just 30 seconds on, this is often being framed as what these international students lose when they can't come to the United States. But the issue of what the United States loses, I mean, it's called a brain drain. Other countries are now calling this a brain gain that they'll get the students. But the shutting down of scientific labs, the lab, the research around Alzheimer's, around cancer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's obvious what's going to happen. The most talented students and faculty from abroad, who until, you know, very recently have come to the United States, will instead go to Europe, or they'll go to Australia, or they'll go to Canada, and all of those countries,
or China, or Russia,
or China, and they'll, you know, all those countries are seeing this as a huge opportunity, as I suppose they should. But it's very sad for the United States, because the United States, since the Second World War, has really led in higher education. You know, these universities, Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, these are the envy of the world, you know, and, you know, like I said earlier, I just cannot imagine the theory, any theory under which these policies are good for the United States at any level.
Jamil Jaffer, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Coming up, we look at Israel's use of Palestinians as human shields in Gaza and the West Bank. We'll talk to Nadav Weiman, a former Israeli soldier who heads the group Breaking the Silence, back in 20 seconds.
Soy el dolor que no siente, soy la memoria olvidada,
Against Everything by Ileana Cabra Hoblar, better known as Ile, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza, where more evidence is coming to light about how Israel has systematically used Palestinians as human shields in violation of both international and Israeli law. That's the conclusion of a new investigation by the Associated Press based on interviews with Israeli soldiers and with Palestinians who said they were used as human shields to inspect buildings, tunnels, and other sites in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The AP reports the Israeli soldiers said the practice was used in part to spare combat dogs from injury or death. One Israeli sergeant admitted to using Palestinians as young as 16 years old as human shields.
In February, the news outlet 972 revealed how Israel used an 80-year-old man as a human shield. Troops tied an explosive cord around his neck, then forced him to search abandoned buildings. After he finished the mission, he was ordered to flee, but then another Israeli unit fatally shot him and his wife. Haaretz and the Red Cross have also documented Israel's use of human shields. The AP report is based in part on testimonies collected by Breaking the Silence, a group made up of former Israeli soldiers opposed to the Israeli occupation. The groups also release photos of Palestinians being used as human shields in Gaza. We're joined now by the group's executive director, Nadav Weiman. He's a former Israeli soldier joining us from Tel Aviv. Thanks so much for being with us. Tell us what information you collected, the Israeli soldiers you talked to, and how exactly they're using Palestinians as human shields.
So, Amy, I've got to say that from the beginning of this war, we got testimonies from soldiers that told us they were ordered by senior officers to grab Palestinians next to them and to use them as human shields, meaning that they were ordered to send Palestinians. Some of them were dressed up with IDF uniforms, had GoPro cameras on their head or on their chest, and then they were sent into tunnels and houses to check that there isn't any IEDs or explosive over there, so the soldier could enter safely or clear the area. And we got testimonies from different units, different times, and places in the Gaza Strip, which shows, as you said, that it's widely spread, this protocol.
And Nadav, as far as you know, how long has this practice been in place?
Now, the first testimony that we have is from December 2023, meaning immediately after the ground invasion started. And the last testimony that we had is from the beginning of this year, beginning of 2025, just before the ceasefire. And it's something that the IDF is using more and more and more units and more areas throughout the war.
And to what extent are you aware of soldiers resisting these orders to use Palestinians as human shields?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Now, almost every soldier in the IDF learned about the fact that we used Palestinians as human shields during the Second Intifada. Back then, we called it the neighbor procedure. When you come to arrest a high-ranking Palestinian or you know that he's armed, so you grab the next-door neighbor and you told the neighbor, you knock on the door, not me, and maybe he will get shot. And if nobody shot him, then we told them, get inside the house, open all of the doors and open all of the lights, so we will be more safe. And that was banned by the Supreme Court in Israel in the end of the Second Intifada. So the reservist in the Israeli army grew up on that history, that we did something, it was bad, but it was banned, and that's it. And now they got a command that is exactly that, but I can say even worse, actually, right? Because he's dressing them up in IDF uniform. Some of the soldiers told us that it's maybe that they will be the target, so they will get shot. Now, the thing is that our testifier told us there was a debate inside their unit. But it's our testifiers, right? I just read an op-ed in Haaretz of an officer that served in Gaza, and he said that almost every platoon is using human shields, right? So our testifiers told us there was a debate. They came to their senior officer and told them, hey, you know, that we were trying to fight, not to use human beings as human shields, or that dehumanization of Palestinians, or that's immoral or illegal, or I don't know what. But they cannot tell you what's going on in the greater IDF. At the moment.
So explain, Nadav Iman, why this is called the mosquito procedure. And also talk about what these Israeli soldiers told you about what happens to the Palestinians, many forced into houses, buildings, tunnels, that are suspected of being booby-trapped, allegedly made to perform tasks like looking for explosives in tunnels.
Yeah, so first of all, a lot of things that the IDF has names for, I don't know the reason, but I can say that mosquito, it's like it's a bug that flies in the air and like you can kill it, who cares about it? And that was the relationship a lot of times between the soldiers and those Palestinian individuals that were used. And that's the word, they were used, right? We have a testifier that called them a sub-army of slaves. Now, the protocol is quite simple. You need that individual with you for a period of time, 2 days, 3 days, a week, 3 weeks. So it means that only when he's scanning a tunnel or a house or an alley, so he doesn't have handcuffs or a blindfold. The rest of the time, when he's with you inside the house, you need to feed him, you need to take him to the bathroom, but he's also handcuffed and blindfolded, so you need to help him. In some unit, there were the mosquitoes inside the house were used to clean the house where the soldier stayed. So it's not only, you know, don't only think about that time in the tunnel when they need to endanger their life, think about the rest of the time, the majority of the day, that they were living with the soldiers inside the house. But again, eventually, they were supposed to be released. So it's, again, I'm quoting that soldier, a sub-army of slaves.
And Nadav, could you talk about the context in which this news has been coming out, where there's mounting anger against Netanyahu, protests all across the country yesterday for refusing to agree to a deal that would guarantee the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza? If you could explain what the mood is in Israel, the repeated calls for Netanyahu to step down. You've said that he's acting like a dictator.
Yeah, so from the very beginning of this war, we and other human rights organizations, we called for a deal to release our hostages, ceasefire, and enter humanitarian aid into Gaza. Now, at the beginning, we were a minority at the protest. But as this war, it's hard for me to call it a war because as a soldier, they told me that the war, it's two armies fighting one another. So is this intensive operation in Gaza went so long, and we killed so many civilians, and we lost so many of our soldiers, and also some of our hostages. More and more Israelis are resisting this war. And if you look at polls in Israel at the moment, you can see that the majority of Israelis, meaning even Bibi's voters, I believe, are against the continuance of this war and pro-hostage deal and pro-ending this war. And you can see the atmosphere on the streets. What happened yesterday, it was the 600th day of this operation or since October 7th. And we saw a lot of anger. You know, protesters in Tel Aviv took over the headquarters of the Likud party in Tel Aviv for a couple of hours, right? And they put signs. They said it's the embassy of Qatar because of the allegation that Qatar paid for the close in, advisors of Bibi to support them more than anything else. But I can say that what changed is in the mid-March, when we returned fighting in Gaza, when we continued bombing in Gaza, and we broke the ceasefire, and we stopped releasing our hostages, the majority of the audience in Israel understood that this is a war to protect Bibi's seat and Bibi's government, not to release our hostages, not to fight Hamas, and not to defend our borders. Because if that was the case, we will go to a hostage deal like Witkoff helped us achieve in the minute Trump stepped into office. Now, what we saw yesterday is more and more Israelis understanding that we are being lied to, that our soldiers are sent to die and to be killed for themselves without any good reason, without releasing our hostages or ending this war.
I wanted to turn for last example to the occupied West Bank. Israel admitting to strapping a wounded Palestinian man to the hood of an Israeli military vehicle during a raid on Jenin. Relatives and neighbors of the man, Mujahed Azmi, said Israeli soldiers used him as a human shield instead of allowing him to get medical care after he'd been shot. This is 13-year-old Al Asmi speaking last year.
We told them we want an ambulance for the wounded person in the room, so the army told us to bring him to them. We got him outside, and for about an hour or half an hour, we kept asking for an ambulance. Then we called one. 15 minutes later, two jeeps came, and they got in here. The troops told us to turn around and not to look, and they put Mujahed on the jeep's hood and took him.
After a video of the incident went viral, the Israeli military released a statement claiming the action was, quote, in violation of orders and standard operating procedures. Nadav Ayman, if you can talk about how Israel is responding now to this latest news of this much more widespread use of exactly this kind of example.
Now, first of all, I've got to say that IDF spokesperson, a lot of times when they are confronted with something bad that soldier did that are against regulation, they said, it's against regulation, we will educate the soldiers, a mistake, and that's it. No investigation, no nothing. Now, I've got to say that now the IDF announced that six investigations were opened after the IDF soldier used Palestinians' human shields in Gaza. And it's a joke. Right, because we have so many more incidents, and even Yaniv Kubovich from Haaretz newspapers published a couple of months ago that Herzi Halevi, then commander-in-chief of the IDF, was sitting in the meeting room while the Mosquito Protocol was discussed, meaning that everybody knew. Now, I've got to say that connects to something a lot bigger in the Israeli society, and that's dehumanization of Palestinians. Right? Since October 7th, it's even on steroids. Right? We have government members that openly talking about genocide. Right. When the head of the Labor Party, Yair Golan, last week said that the right-wing politician likes to kill Palestinian kids and babies, he was called as a traitor by our government. You know, we have ministers saying there isn't any innocent in Gaza, that all of the Palestinians are assisting terror or terrorists by themselves. And that seeps down into the IDF. Into commands that soldiers are getting. And if you connect that with the fact that we have more and more soldier officers and commanders in the IDF that comes from the religious right wing or from the settler movement and believe that maybe it's a holy war, not a war of defending ourselves, you can understand why you have such a huge amount of those kinds of incidents. Dehumanization of Palestinians in Israel became something so common that it also leads to this kind of practices inside the IDF.
Nadav Ayman, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Breaking the Silence, a whistleblower group of former Israeli soldiers. When we come back, Israeli troops have fatally shot at least 10 Palestinians as they attempted to collect food and aid amidst the chaotic unveiling of a new Israeli-U.S.-backed aid distribution plan run by a shadowy U.S. group. We'll speak to Jeremy Scahill of Drop Site News in 20 seconds. Oh, 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 oh. Rosemond in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
An Israeli-U.S. plan to sideline the United Nations aid delivery system is continuing to cause chaos in Gaza. At least 10 Palestinians have been shot dead as Israeli troops have repeatedly opened fire at newly established aid distribution sites. The aid is being distributed by a shadowy U.S. group registered in Delaware called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. A separate U.S. company called Safe Reach Solutions is helping to provide security. The New York Times reports that firm is run by a former senior CIA officer named Philip Riley, who reportedly helped train the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s. The UN and international aid groups have condemned the new Israeli-U.S. plan. This is UNRWA Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini.
The model of aid distribution proposed by Israel does not align with core humanitarian principle. It will deprive large part of Gaza, the highly vulnerable people, of desperately needed assistance.
We're joined now by Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of DropSite News, recently wrote an article headlined Netanyahu, Gaza Aid Scheme Offers Israel Symbolic Cover to Finish the Genocide. Jeremy Scahill has also been reporting on proposals for a new ceasefire in Gaza. We'll get to that in a minute, Jeremy. But why don't you lay out what is going on? This shadowy group that has moved in, condemned by humanitarian aid organizations, by the United Nations. Talk about who they are and what's happening.
I mean, first of all, Amy, we should be very clear that this cutout of a company, you know, cutout is a term of espionage. It was established by people with ties to the CIA and Israeli intelligence, was meant to serve as part of Netanyahu's war of annihilation. Netanyahu himself said the quiet part out loud in a recent speech when he said that he was getting some pressure even from his most passionate backers in the Republicans in the Senate. And he said, you know, that they didn't want the optics of starving Palestinians and that this could hinder the ability of the United States to continue arming and supporting Netanyahu. And so they wanted to give the veneer of some form of aid. And Netanyahu and Israel have been at war against UNRWA, the UN agency that was established in the aftermath of the Nakba in the late 1940s, when the state of Israel was imposed on Palestine as a European colonial settler state. And so this serves two purposes. It allowed Netanyahu to say, look, we're letting aid in and we're doing it so that Hamas can't steal it, which, by the way, was a lie. And even Biden's top humanitarian official, David Satterfield, said this week that there was no evidence ever presented by Israel that Hamas was stealing or hoarding the aid. So part of it was to give the veneer of we're doing something humanitarian. The other part of it was to continue the war against UNRWA, to destroy the premier aid organizations serving Palestinian refugees, forcibly displaced people. And UNRWA, its very existence, Netanyahu and Israel hate because it recognizes the international laws that say that the Palestinians have a right to return to their land that they started to be to lose in 1947, 1948, when the Nakba began. So they created this shell company with ties to American intelligence officers as a way of further destroying UNRWA, but also serving Netanyahu agenda. They then bring in an American mercenary company that, you know, Blackwater style guys that you saw in Iraq and Afghanistan throughout the so-called war on terror. And then they created what international aid officials have said are concentration camp or internment camp like conditions. Others have likened it to ghetto style conditions where Palestinians are going to be forced to stand out in the heat all day in barbed wire fence enclosures looking like a cage. And then they get a box with a paltry amount of food aid in it. There's no medicine. There's no infant formula. This is all just trickery that is being used to further the genocide. And Amy, I've been talking to people. A personal friend of mine whose family is from Khan Yunis, four members of his family were shot sniper style yesterday by the Israeli military when they went to pick up these aid boxes at one of the two sites, the one near Rafah. What is happening is that the Israelis are also using this as an intelligence operation. They've snatched, kidnapped a number of Palestinians. They've interrogated them when they don't get the answers they want. They've disappeared them. They haven't given any mechanism for how people are supposed to line up or know where to go. What we're hearing from sources on the ground is that word just spreads via WhatsApp and text messages. Oh, there's going to be aid delivered in this place. People go there and it's just pure chaos. So none of this is by accident. This is by design. And you have, on the one hand, a pittance of aid that is being actually distributed relative to what is needed just to address the basic starvation factor in Gaza right now. And on the other hand, Israel is using this and the desperation of people to further dehumanize Palestinians. And when they go to try to desperately grab whatever aid they can, as we saw happen at a UN warehouse, then they say, well, Hamas is shooting starving people trying to get food. No, Israel has intentionally starved the population of Gaza now for 3 months. They have continued the campaign of dehumanization, and they're using food as a weapon of war in an effort to further dehumanize Palestinians. And the last thing I'll say about this is Netanyahu and Bezalel Smotrich, who's in the war cabinet, both said that the point of this is to lure Palestinians as though they're animals going into a cage, lure them with the bait of promise of aid, and then entrap them in the south of Gaza, where they can either kill them in an increasingly shrinking killing cage or lock that cage and ship them off to another country. They call it Trump's plan, but actually it's been Netanyahu's life's work to try to erase Palestinians as a people and as a territory.
Well, on Wednesday, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation posted a video online showing Palestinians lined up cheering at a new aid distribution site. The post includes this message: humanity shines as thousands cheer the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, heralding a new era of hope and compassion.
I mean,
who's totally masked, making a heart sign. The Pulitzer Prize-winning Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha responded to the video by writing, quote, "Concentration camp, humiliating people starved for 86 days. Shame on this world." Jeremy, your response.
I mean, there are no words to offer in response, because we know that the entire point of this was to serve the Israeli genocide against the Palestinian people. We know that the agenda at play here was to try to lure them with food as a bait to try to wipe them out. This is part of the life's work, the central life's work of Benjamin Netanyahu. And in fact, a recent public opinion poll in Israel said that 82% of Jewish Israelis want Palestinians removed from Gaza. The world understands what the agenda is. Many governments that are now starting to speak up were enablers of this. Many news organizations are starting to speak up that were enablers of this. History should never forget what the United States facilitated under both Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
Very quickly, Jeremy, the issue of the ceasefire proposals, you've spoken with Hamas officials. Explain what's happening right now.
Yeah, well, Amy, I actually just saw the latest draft that was circulated by Steve Witkoff. This was announced yesterday with Donald Trump. And basically what's happening here is Hamas had agreed to a version of this framework that they were told by a U.S. emissary would satisfy Donald Trump. The Israelis went nuts over that. And so what's happening right now is there's an attempt to amend language. It boils down to this, Amy. Israel wants to be able to continue the genocide if it determines it wants to do so. Hamas has said it's a red line if the deal does not include a clear path to negotiations for a permanent end to the war. So what is happening right now is that there are reviews happening on Hamas's side, on Israel's side, and we're going to have to see. Donald Trump is the defining factor. Everyone involved knows that the only person capable of ending this genocidal war is Donald Trump. It's a sick reality. It has to do with his business interests in the Gulf and elsewhere and his image of himself. But it all boils down to that. It has nothing to do with a humanitarian objective or saving Palestinian lives. It has everything to do with whether Donald Trump decides Netanyahu's war is bad for his business politically and his personal family business.
We just have 30 seconds, but you've reported someone who served as a backdoor negotiator for the Trump administration is Dr. Bashar Ababa. Can you explain who he is?
Bashar Ababa was the head of Arab Americans for Trump. You know, Donald Trump tried to hit Kamala Harris because he knew that she was very unpopular because of her Gaza stance. He's been the U.S. emissary that's been dealing directly with Hamas. I'm told that often what happens is Ababa is in the room with Hamas officials. They then get Witkoff on the line or they communicate by text messages. You know, this is a lower level official, but it seems clear that that backdoor communication is what led to Witkoff announcing that there may be a breakthrough imminently.
Jeremy Scahill, we want to thank you so much for being with us, co-founder of DropSite News. We'll link to your recent reports. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. You can find out more about these full-time jobs at democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.